Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Martin Amis, whose latest book is House of Meetings, a novel. Recent books include Cobra the Dread, Experience, a memoir, and a novel, Yellow Dog. House of Meetings concerns the gulags. It concerns life in Russia, 1945 up until the present, or close to the present, and seems to have been an outgrowth of an earlier book, a nonfiction book you wrote called Cobra the Dread. It brings up the question, what brought you to writing about Stalin and what happened in Russia under Stalin, first from a nonfictional perspective and then from a fictional perspective?
Well, it's become a habit of mine to look into something in the guise of a journalist or an amateur historian, to process a lot of information and write a nonfiction thing about it. And then, sometimes seems to happen, after a couple of years, you find it sunk down to a different level inside you, and you have more to say, and you say it from a kind of deeper perspective, and then it takes the form of fiction, and you can manipulate facts a bit, and you're not so wedded to the actual. In this case, it was a feeling that what would it have been like to live through the Gulag experience and not be someone like Solzhenitsyn or Yevgeny Ginsberg or Yanush Badakh, these great-souled survivors who've written these great memoirs of the camp experience? What would it be like to have had your integrity really challenged and vitiated by the experience? You know, it's often said of the memoirists of the Gulag that they're atypical because they're always the intelligentsia who write these memoirs, not the guard, not the common criminals, etc. But they're atypical in another sense, in that they are these indomitable spirits. And we're not all indomitable spirits. So this book tells of two brothers who, in very different ways, you know, they not only have the 10-some years in the camp, but it's how it affects the rest of their lives and what it actually does to their souls.
In reading Cobra the Dread, it's pretty clear that so many people did not survive, and yet these brothers did manage to survive, so to some degree they were a little bit atypical, weren't they?
Yeah, they were, but, you know, a memoirist is by definition a survivor.
Right.
And even the survivors, I strongly suspect, did not walk away as these great memoirists did. Just by reading the last page of their books, you can see that they're on to fresh experience. You know, their hearts are still ardent and almost youthful. You know, what would it be like if that didn't happen to you, that the rest of your life was infiltrated by the experience and ruined by it?
Your major characters are the protagonist. I'm not sure if he has a name, does he?
He doesn't have a name, which is kind of interesting because in the first draft, I only used his name once, and I thought to myself, he doesn't want a name. And since my ideal model for this book was Conrad Under Western Eyes, where the narrator isn't named, I thought, you know, take that hint from your own unconscious and don't give him a name. And I don't know what you gain from it, if anything, but I thought, you know, he just doesn't want to have a name.
Well, you gave him a specific history. He's kind of a thug who rapes his way through World War II, which kind of leaves us feeling that he's not that good a guy, and in fact what he does during the course of the book isn't all that wonderful.
No, it's a kind of refrain in the book that he says of his brother and his brother says of him, you know, what good boys we were before. The narrator, unlike the brother, who's too young, can point, by way of mitigation, to the Second World War and 4 years in the dirtiest fight in human history against the Nazis. There is a moral rot in war, and as he admits, he did rape his way across what would soon be Eastern Germany in the last year of the war. So he's brutalized. At one point, talking about Robert Graves, because he's a great Anglophile, he talks about Goodbye to All That, where Graves reveals that it took him 10 years to recover morally from the First World War. And as the narrator says in my book, he says, yeah, but Graves did his recuperating on some island in the Mediterranean. I did my recuperating in penal servitude above the Arctic Circle. So 4 years in the war against fascism, then he comes back and finds himself accused of being fascist by a government which is itself turning fascist. So the capsizal of everything within him is pretty complete.
The book begins by listing the various elements of the camp that he's at. Now, is this a specific real camp, real place, or is this a fictional place?
It's fictionalized and given a fictional name, but in fact it's called Norlag. You know, those who know the field will recognize that it's Norilsk, which is still there, and it's a completely ersatz city built beyond the Arctic Circle. It's one of those Soviet grandiose, violent ideas that you build a whole city in a place that is dark, you know, for 3 months of the year. But there were several Arctic camps, Kolymar, Verkuta, and this was one of them.
The people who were fighting there, there's the Urkas, who I guess they're the natives to the land, pretty much?
No, they're hereditary criminals. They're like sort of circus strongmen criminals, all covered in tattoos and earrings, you know, rather reminiscent of our own day. And they've been around in Russia since the time of troubles in the 17th century, and they're an underworld. They're still there.
I got the impression it was an ethnic group, but it isn't.
No, it's a social group, and they were in camps all over the country.
And then there are the leeches.
They're the common criminals.
The fascists, who were primarily people who were arrested for no reason at all.
No reason at all.
And the feces eaters, let's call them.
Yeah.
That would be the people at the lowest end of the spectrum.
They're also called the goners and the wicks. They're the people who can't work anymore and who eat garbage.
And then the pigs, who are the administrators. This came from reading Solzhenitsyn?
From reading Solzhenitsyn and others. I've written a novel about the Holocaust, where I had an absolute iron rule that I would make nothing up, I would contribute nothing.
And that would be Time's Arrow?
Time's Arrow. With this, and it shows one of the many differences between the two Holocausts, the Russian and the German, that I didn't feel that restriction. And I did elaborate a little bit on camp life, and even, I'm ashamed to say, made it a little bit worse here and there than it actually was.
You have another character named Zoya, who is the idealized woman that they look up to. There's been some criticism of the fact that she's so idealized, yet from my perspective, she didn't seem that idealized.
So I don't think she is. I mean, the criticism saying she's a male fantasy figure is ridiculous. All that means is that she's pretty. The suggestion being that, you know, if you're going to write a serious novel, the woman can't be attractive. She is beautiful, and she is shapely, but she's also very vulnerable, and she has this peculiarity in that she's very shaky on her legs, because as a child, as an infant, she never learned how to crawl, and I don't know why, but that seemed very central to my feeling about her, that she is statuesque, but also with feet of clay, somehow.
Wouldn't it be also that by virtue of the character's obsession with her from before, he would tend to idealize her afterward because he's stuck for 10 years in the gulag?
Yeah, I mean, I think the subtext of those criticisms is that certain reviewers think that novelists, you know, are strangers to pretty women, that, you know, that they can't pull pretty women. They can only hang out with eyesores, and they're reduced to having book-length male fantasies about the pretty ones. But actually, I mean, if she's based on anyone physically, she's based on my wife. So I plead innocent.
There's another character later on in the book, after they get out of the gulag, named Ananias, who is a playwright. Now, obviously, you're doing something with the name there. Is he based on anybody specific or on... There's a poet you mentioned in Koba the Dread, a terrible poet. Is that who he's based on?
No, he's not. I mean, this is how it went for writers in the Soviet Union. If you were talented, then you did what I think it was Isaac Babel did, where he said, "I've invented a new genre, that of silence." You kept your mouth shut if you were talented, because to be faithful to your talent, you would have to be a dissenting voice. There was just no way round there. Some talented writers didn't shut up and wrote. Mayakovsky and Senin, the two poets, come to mind, and they both committed suicide. If you were talentless, you could collaborate frictionlessly. You could just regard it as a game where you towed the general line and had some fun in your own way. I call him Ananias, this old playwright. I thought it would be interesting to have someone who was in between, who did have some talent, who did have a high level of perception and a melodious prose style. It means false artist, I take it to mean. He was talented, but he did collaborate, and with the results that I hope to portray, and that he's lost his manhood, and his whole physical being has curdled, as is said of him and of every other Russian, that they seem permanently to be fighting off an insanity of bitterness, because they've been placed in such an impossible position and have twisted themselves into this funny shape in order to survive it.
The research on life in Russia, apart from the gulag, where did that come from?
I read, you know, all the great books about post-Bolshevik Russia, David Remnick, Andrew Meyer, and tried to build up an imaginative picture of what happens after. As he says, it's not third world, it's not second world, it's fourth world Russia now. It's post-industrial. and great human experiments and physical experiments have been conducted on this country and not cleaned up after. And this is the mess that remains.
Did you ever make it over there during the Soviet era?
I've never set foot in Russia in my life, which is sort of weird since I've written two books about the place. There was this enormous reservoir of sympathy for the Russian experiment, which I don't think was at all ignoble. I think very understandable. And it wasn't just the intellectuals, supposedly soft-headed intellectuals. It was the businessmen, sociologists, historians, everyone. There was such a surge of hope and faith in the Soviet idea. And that took, you know, perhaps half a century to dissipate, or longer. Not until Shevchenko in, when was it, sort of 46, 47, did it, the evidence of horror start to be unignorable.
I still think, even in the 60s, the idea was this was a wonderful experiment gone wrong, that there was still an idealism about where it started. And in Cope of the Dread, you pretty much put a stop to it, that the famines and the forced terror were pretty much from the beginning.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Stalin was merely a logical extension of Lenin. No, the dynamism and horror of the experiment were there from the start. The feeling now, I think, is that it's changed in this way, that we used to think that it was a marvelous idea that had gone wrong. In fact, it was a terrible idea that they did, you know, amazingly well with for quite a long time.
I think nobody expected for the rot to be so deep that it would fall within an hour. The whole idea.
Yeah, Bruce Chatwin, the late Bruce Chatwin, in a short book called Utz, was very prescient about this, and he said that, I think he was writing about Eastern Europe, but he said communism will disappear not with a cataclysm, but like autumn leaves scurrying down the street, as if there'd never been, you know.
In writing Cope of the Dread, you list the genocides of the Soviet system, starting with the collectivization, the famine of 1930 to 32. The 37-38 Reign of Terror, World War II. After the war, it began to get better.
The famine immediately after the war, and then as Stalin was fading, they were building up for another terror, an anti-Semitic terror, amazingly. This is sort of not very present in the consciousness of the West. There was going to be another Holocaust, another Jewish Holocaust, with the remaining 2.5 million Jews, 2.5 having been killed in the Holocaust and in the war. They were going to banish the Jews to a wisely uninhabited region called, I think, Brobidjistan, on the North Chinese border. The whole thing was going to be initiated by the hanging of the Jewish doctors in Red Square. So this was the plan. They were already building barracks, according to Solzhenitsyn, on the North Chinese border. If Stalin hadn't died, that's what would have happened.
This has been one of your primary interests of late. Did it just kind of seep into your consciousness as you read these books? Or was there some kind of aha moment prior to writing Cope of the Dread?
There was a deep curiosity about my father's attachment to the Communist Party up until 1956, and then his flip. He didn't go from being a communist to being a non-communist. He went from being a communist to being an anti-communist, which is just as much of an ideology and just as dangerous in that it gave us, for instance, Vietnam. And I wondered about that difference between his mind and mine, that he was open to ideology in a way that I don't think I am. But I think particularly for this novel, if not for Cope the Dread, it all goes back to my teenage years and reading the great Russians, in particular Dostoevsky, described in this book as Dostoevsky, that old jailbird, windbag, and genius. He is a terrible windbag and full of rubbishy ideas, but he is just unmistakably a genius. That whole Russian complication, the Russian perversity, the Russian habit of inventing additional difficulties, almost in the French way, the jeûner, the act gratuit, you know, where you do things without motivation just to make life more difficult for everyone. That deeply fascinating to a 17-year-old, you know, who's having the adolescent cafard and full of lassitude and disgust and directionlessness. So it really got into me there, the Russian perversity. And I think, you know, that's the roots of both these books are really that early.
You're listening to an interview with Martin Amis, whose latest book is House of Meetings. Places like the House of Meetings, getting certificate of rehabilitation, calling it the Zona, that's all real, right?
That's all real. The House of Meetings was really, reading about that in Anne Applebaum's book, Gulag, was the necessary throb for this book because, unbelievably, there were conjugal visits in the Gulag, beginning in the 30s, I think, so that courageous women would travel for weeks, sometimes months, in freezing conditions on crowded trains to get to the Gulag, these Arctic camps, just to spend one night with their husband. And these meetings were always disastrous, pretty much, for various reasons. And the husbands would come staggering out of the house of meetings and were often speechless for weeks after these encounters. And what moved me most was that this is a Polish memoirist who said that although everyone was humanly very reduced and very savage with each other, that no one would rag these guys who came out of the house of meetings. No one would jeer at them or taunt them, that their suffering was respected in silence by all prisoners. And I thought to have such a human sympathy at such a time, in such a place, I thought was very affecting.
Martin Amis, I'd like to expand the discussion because, you know, we live inside history. We learn things. We learn about what was going on in Russia. We do see elements of fascism, Islamic fundamentalists. We see it in the Republican Party in America. When I read a book like Coba the Dread, and then I hear about the Attorney General of the United States saying habeas corpus doesn't exist in America, and understanding that the lack of habeas corpus is one of the primary motivations for getting people to the gulags, it scares the heck out of me.
Yeah, Lincoln suspended habeas corpus at the beginning of the Civil War, and he did so with great gravity, knowing how open to abuse this now was. You know, I would hesitate to use the word fascist in relation to American politics. There are a million things wrong with it, but I think the traditions and the institutions are too strong. Even when the system has come under such stress, it was revealed in Bob Woodward's latest book that Bush said to Prince Bandar, whoever it was, of Saudi Arabia, he said, "The prisoners we can't get anything out of, we'll give to you." And he said that on September the 13th, 2001. That's how quickly the moral rot came in. And I think looking back, when we do look back on this period, when historians do look back, I think they'll conclude that, as usual, the state wildly overreacted to terror. States always turn to torture when faced with terror, because they think, off come the gloves and now this is hardball and all the rest of it. It's always a mistake. Do not join in the moral collapse, the moral crash that your enemies, they're hoping to entrain. And I think we will work out a strategy for prevailing over what is absolutely fascistic, I mean, super fascistic enemy, Islamism. It's amazing in England how people appease it and make excuses for it and become the apologists for it. And, you know, let's just list the qualities of Islamism. It is racist, misogynistic, homophobic, inquisitional, totalitarian, imperialist, and genocidal. Not things you associate with the left normally, but our enemies do have, to put it brutally, do have this one inestimable advantage in that they are non-white. And when the guilty liberal sees someone who isn't white, they think, ooh, there's a good chance that they're doing these horrible things because we did horrible things to them in the past. This is very lazy, and Paul Berman has called it, you know, rationalist naivety. What we have to identify, and it's onerous doing this, is a death cult and a cult of irrationality. It isn't a logical response to wrongdoing on our part in the past or the distant past.
The argument that I see is that people flock to Islamism for various reasons, and perhaps if, say, America had not done what it had done, the magnetism of Islamism might not have been as strong, and there might be fewer recruits, many fewer recruits.
Yeah. Lenin and Stalin and Hitler knew well. You do get an amazing surge if A, you turn your back on reason. Lenin and Hitler in their writings would never use the word reason without putting in some pejorative adjective like cowardly reason or abject reason or contemptible reason. You kiss goodbye to reason, and for a moment, for a while, everything looks possible. And also you embrace death. As the Bolsheviks say, you have contempt for death, contempt for life, and contempt for death. And this is how great things could be achieved. This is how history can be accelerated. And for a while, this is enormously energizing to turn your back on life and on reason. But, you know, my deep feeling is that once you do that, you do have this power surge, but also, after a while, the ground gets swamp-like under your feet. You know, reality can't sustain this great reversal that you've undertaken. And these very wicked ideologies and creedal waves just burn themselves out.
Hopefully before too much damage gets done. But getting back to what you were saying before, you know, if you're going to use the phrase, the cliche, desperate times call for desperate measures. You know, we see how that could be misused by people who are looking to misuse it, say, in Washington. But if times are desperate and you're poor, then you do turn to these things. So the question is, what role does America and the West have in the rise of Islamic fascism? This does not, to any degree, excuse Islamic fascism.
We have overreacted, and I would take the perhaps even boringly centrist view that what we should have done was finish the job in Afghanistan. We should have been tearing up the earth looking for Osama bin Laden. We should be able by now to point to Afghanistan as a job well done, and provably so, in that, and this is still the case, that something like 2.5 million Afghanis have returned to Afghanistan since the fall of the Taliban. Not the genocide that Chomsky warned us of, but in fact genogenesis, the creation of people. Instead, we went on this insane divagation to Iraq. Not that Iraq was not a problem, but this was not the time to do it. An axiom is emerging now among people who think about terrorism long term, is that the real danger of terrorism is not what it inflicts, it's in what it provokes. So September the 11th could be absorbed, could be contained by American society. It didn't threaten the basis of American society. But the response to it in Iraq has set off what could be, you know, a vast and multiform disaster that will take generations to recover from. So, you know, that's the danger. And curtailing the freedoms of citizens in the home country also undermines us, does not bolster us.
I guess my fear, and maybe you're over in England, you have different fears, is that we have people, and we don't have fascism here in America, but we have people who we could call fascists. And what I see when I see what the Bush administration is doing is I see people who are looking in that direction, and they're using whatever methods they can, and that includes 9/11, to propel this country in that direction.
And that has to be resisted. But, you know, what hasn't happened? Any definition of fascism would have to include some measure of xenophobia, fear of the other. And we haven't seen that here. We haven't seen reprisals against the Islamic community, nor have we seen, as we've seen in England, terrorism from Americans. And that's because of the great fact that America's an immigrant society. You know, a Pakistani in Boston can say, "I'm an American," and all he's doing is stating the obvious. A Pakistani in Bradford or in Bruges or in Berlin can't say the same thing in the same way at all. So, you know, there are strengths that I don't think will be eroded. Perhaps the most doom-laden thing you can say is that our period of freedom was a historical anomaly, and that, you know, we now enter the age of the closed-circuit television camera and the thumbprint and the tapped phone line.
And that will come whether there's what you call horrorism or not. It's moving in that direction. They're finding reasons to do it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm willing to sacrifice some of my autonomy as a citizen for more security. And I think everyone who has nothing to hide would go a certain amount along that road. It just has to be very carefully measured and monitored.
When I read Cobra the Dread, and I went through about 120 pages of it last night, I'm seeing it both as history and as cautionary tale.
I think what we're learning all over again is that man, apart from being, you know, history tells us that we're not a peaceable species, but we're not a rational species either. We're only evanescently or fleetingly rational. And I think, you know, a time of exaggerated respect for reason is what is needed. And I think there are worse things in the world than George Bush. But what I don't forgive him for is, we don't hear it much anymore, but the sacralizing of the war against terror was an enormous plunge into the irrational. And to meet irrationality with irrationality is, you know, the way to hell.
I think one of the reasons why Americans, in some respect, are less likely, perhaps, than liberals in Britain to view Islamism in a positive light is that we can compare it to American Christianism.
That's right. I mean, Europe almost got through to the other side of secularism. You know, we don't understand religious motivation. We still respect it disgracefully, but America, a country where, what is it, 99% believe that God listens to their prayers, are very vulnerable to a contagion of the irrational.
Yeah, so we can see it on all sides. It maybe gives us a little bit more perspective.
That's right. When Bush says, you know, one of those code words where he signals to his base, that he said, "The Almighty's gift of freedom to the world." It's not the Almighty's gift. It's man's gift, and it's a fragile thing.
Martin Amis, I'd like to switch gears for a second. You have a satire called Yellow Dog that got some of the most contradictory reviews I've seen in a book in a long time. Surprisingly controversial for what is essentially just a satire. What's going on there, and how did you respond to that?
You say all that needs to be said when you say it's a satire. It's not a very wild satire. It's not a very fantastic satire, but it is a satire. And I think we're entering a period where satire is almost impossible to, not to write, but to get away with, because we're moving against the flow of humor. Humor is, by definition, not politically correct. It always supposes a certain degree of superiority. There's always a but in a joke. You're always looking down on someone with a joke. And satire looks down from quite a height. You know, it's militant irony. It's rampaging irony. It got some very good reviews, but it got not just bad reviews, but everyone who could hold a pen in England was queuing up to beat it up. It touches on things that sets alarm bells going, you know, and you make jokes that are to do with racism and sexism and so on. And people are so policed in their minds about this that they respond with violence.
Years ago, an American writer, Bret Easton Ellis, wrote American Psycho. I don't know if you're familiar with the book.
Yes,
it's a very, very funny book, and yet it was treated as if it was a dissertation on male violence.
It threw me a bit. It's a very good sign, I think, if you write a satirical book and everyone gets in a tizzy and gets it slightly wrong. I think you've succeeded. But you're going to get, you know, very high-minded treatment now. It's not a good time for that sort of thing.
You recently wrote Experience, which is a memoir. When you're working on a memoir like this, how cautious are you in terms of your relationships with friends? I know that in Coba the Dread, even though you're good friends with Christopher Hitchens, you two had a public, not necessarily private, row about it. How do you find that place that makes you feel both safe and yet not safe at the same time?
Well, I don't think I made any enemies with either of these books. You know, my friendship with Christopher Hitchens is immune to any kind of wobble or public row. I mean, nothing would affect our friendship. And I think actually you find out what sort of person you are and whether you are a great harborer of grudges and whether you've got a lot of scores to settle. And I found I didn't have any. And it's not because I'm suppressing it. It's because it isn't there. And I'm writing now a novel that covers much of the same ground, a very autobiographical novel. And
that's The Pregnant Widow.
Yeah. And you might think that, in the novel, he'll really have a chance to settle matters with his enemies. But again, there's no sort of ill feeling in me that's boiling up and trying to get out. So that's the safe place to be when you're a nice guy.
Christopher Hitchens himself, from our perspective, I don't know the man, but I've seen him and I've read him for years, seems to have made this giant switch from left to right. Is that true? What was going on with him?
I think that's not fair to say that he's gone from left to right. I think he's attacking Islamofascism from the left. That's his position. As he said, he's kind of hitched his wagon to the neocon wagon because he thinks that they're the ones who have an idea of the seriousness of the challenge. You know, he wouldn't mind me saying this, and I've said it to his face, that he's also a world heavyweight champion contrarian. One of his books is Letters to a Young Contrarian. If you have real prowess of contrariety, as the Hitch definitely has, then you not only choose the most difficult position, but you choose the most difficult position for you. That's what he's done.
It certainly hasn't endeared him, though not too long ago he wrote a couple of articles about election fraud in this country, and people seemed shocked that he would come out and talk about the fraud committed by Republicans, but if he hasn't changed that much, he would.
He hasn't changed at all. I mean, they think that he's now Bush's creature, but he in no sense is he that. He's for Bush on the war on terror and, you know, no further.
But how can you be for Bush given Iraq now?
Christopher's position, I hope all our positions, are not monolithic. You do not come to these questions, if you're sensible, you do not come from an ideological position from the left or the right. He was for the war in Iraq, and I think he's horrified by how things have turned out, but he still thinks it was the right thing to do. He thinks that Iraq would have had to be dealt with at some time or another, and it was a question of timing, and it's certainly true. I think that the idea that Iraq was just going to bubble on and be containable forever is idle. an Iraq under the sway of Uday Hussein, perhaps with a reawakened interest in weapons of mass destruction, would not be tolerable to the West. So it perhaps, because it comes down to a question of timing, I think it was the wrong timing. He thinks it was the right.
I think it was the wrong timing and the wrong people.
I think the old joke about it should have been Iran and not Iraq, and where was the president's spell check czar, I think is actually painfully true. I think Iran was ripe for a regime change in a way that Iraq was not. There are three structural reasons why we shouldn't have gone into Iraq. And one is that Iraq was never a real country. To establish a democracy in a country that used to be three countries, and it was only, you know, Winston Churchill who divided them. There's also the question of, you know, the sacred nature of Baghdad. Tehran is not a sacred city at all. It's cobbled together, you know, 100 years ago. Baghdad is the home of the caliphate, and that will be a recruiting sergeant for Islamism for a generation.
Martin Amis, your next book is The Pregnant Widow. Feminism is kind of a subject of that.
Yeah. To go glance back at the Russians for a moment, the Russian 19th century thinker Alexander Herzen, in a beautiful trope, said that when there's a revolution, any political or cultural or psychological, one should on the whole be braced to have got rid of the old order and to be confronted by the new. He said, but what you do not get is a newborn child. What you get is a pregnant widow. You know, the father is dead, the child is not yet born. And he said there will be much trial and tribulation until you hear the infant's cries. And I think feminism, you know, that's very true of feminism, that you don't get rid of 5 million years of male dominance and male aggression. You do not get rid of that with the snap of a finger. And that feminism has a long way to go, and, you know, men have a long way to go in adapting to it. And I would say, you know, I'd guess that feminism is about halfway through its second trimester.
You've been listening to an interview with Martin Amis, whose latest book is House of Meetings, which is a novel. To put House of Meetings in perspective, I think that one might want to read Coba the Dread before reading House of Meetings, but the two of them form kind of a duality.
One is nonfiction and the other is fiction, so read the nonfiction first is my advice.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.